The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS, 91.7 FM, Storrs, and WHUS.org, UConn's Radio for the People. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, a conversation between a Yale theologian and a New York Times columnist on the subject of character, flourishing, and the good life. The event featuring Miroslav Volf, founder and director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, and David Brooks, a pundit for the New York Times, PBS, NPR, among other honking big outlets, interviewed each other a few weeks ago at Yale's Battelle Chapel before a packed house. One of the organizers, Matt Crosman, of Yale's Life Worth Living program, kindly provided the audio of the event. I'll post full details about the presenters and organizers at the ReasonablyCatholic.com website, as well as the full audio. Today's airing is necessarily, because of time, an edited version. You may remember that back in October, Matt Crosman and his friend Tom Krattenmaker, who's the spokesman for Yale Divinity School, came on the air to talk about a grant that Yale had received to study joy and the good life. You can also find that episode archived at ReasonablyCatholic.com. We'll be back in a moment with the conversation on character, flourishing, and the good life with David Brooks and Miroslav Volf.
What if it wasn't always about getting ahead? What if you didn't care about being on the fast track? What if your career goals were to change? Instead of flying off to the big interview, what if you flew somewhere else altogether? To embark on a different track, to volunteer in ways you never dreamed of, in places you never imagined yourself being. Like a tiny island in the Pacific, barely visible on a map, but where needs are easy to see. Or a village on the African continent, where just a little training in HIV awareness can change the fate of thousands. What if you decided to share your skills with others and help someone else get ahead? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
It is my privilege to introduce our first guest of honor this evening. David Brooks is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times and appears regularly on PBS NewsHour, NPR's All Things Considered, and NBC's Meet the Press. He teaches at Yale University, is a senior fellow of the Jackson Institute of Global Affairs, and is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is a best-selling author of Bobos in Paradise, The New Upper Class and How They Got There, On Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have in the Future Tense, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement, and The Road to Character.
Our second guest of honor is Miroslav Volf, the founder and director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, and Henry B. Wright Professor of Theology at Yale Divinity School. Professor Volf studied philosophy and theology in his native Croatia and in the United States, and earned doctoral and postdoctoral degrees with highest honors from the University of Tübingen, Germany. His book, Exclusion and Embrace, was a winner of the prestigious Grawemeyer Award in Religion, and Christianity Today named it one of the 100 most important religious books of the 20th century. His most recent book is Flourishing: Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World. Please join us in welcoming to the stage David Brooks and Miroslav Volf.
Thank you. you. Welcome to today's debate on human flourishing. Miroslav is for it, I'm against it. I actually come from a series of institutions that have been hostile to U.S. flourishing for decades. The New York Times, where I'm the conservative columnist, a job I'm likened to being the chief rabbi at Mecca. The University of Chicago, which has been hostile to my flourishing for 4 years. My favorite saying about Chicago is, it's a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. Okay, so we'll start with a simple and obvious question. Your book is called Flourishing. What does it look like?
That's a great question to start. So I think of flourishing as having three formal components. One component is life is going well, for one. The other component is life is being led well. And the third one, in some sense, life feels also good. The first, life going well, describes the circumstances of our lives. We need to have a level of peace in social settings. We need to have our bodies nourished in certain ways for us to be able to say that we flourish. Second is life being led well. We need to act in ways that are appropriate. We need to have a form of character that is appropriate. And the third component, probably very popular these days in the wider culture, is life has to feel good, feel right. And that can be, sometimes people think of it as kind of unimportant in some ways, but at the same time, without a sense of life feeling right, we cannot be said to flourish. In the biblical traditions, both Jewish and Christian, these are summed up in terms like peace for life going well, righteousness for life being led well, and joy for life feeling just right.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking of Kanye West. He would say, my life is going well, I got a lot of money, my life is being led well, Taylor Swift hates me, and I'm certainly feeling good about myself. So that seems maybe not as tight a definition as one you would want.
Well, I think those are formal components of it, right? So everything depends not so much of all these three things being present, but everything depends, I think, on giving these components their the kind of robust character. If you think of it simply as our subjective understanding of it, you might feel okay for a while, and then you might not quite feel okay for a while. Flourishing, I think, is something also that extends over a period of time. Flourishing is something that characterizes our entire lives. And there are these rich traditions of thinking about what it means for circumstances to be right, what it means to inhabit, for instance, in just and peaceful social order. There are a whole tradition of thinking of what does righteousness actually mean? What does it mean acting rightly so that it isn't simply kind of a subjectively felt action?
So for your flourishing, does it involve some eternal external standard?
I think it does. It does. I think that's really where the great traditions come, whether they're philosophical or whether they're religious traditions. They kind of map for us the account of who the self is, what the social relations are, and what the good is that we ought to aspire. And these traditions are almost like a kind of repositories of the standards by which we evaluate our lives. Mm-hmm. And obviously there are multiple traditions and they sometimes conflict, and that's really what the course A Life Worth Living is about. That's partly also what my book is about, is trying to figure out how among these major traditions that hold not just opinions of people, but affections of people and shape their practices, how we can engage in meaningful debate in the very much pluralistic world that globalization has created.
Right, but in the book, and even the title of the book, it's not just traditions you're talking about in the book. In the course, you've got secular traditions. In the title, you've got religion.
Yeah.
So the subtitle is Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World, which raises the question, why do we need religion in a globalized world?
He does raise that question, and hopefully the book provides certain answers for it. I think, so the purpose of the book, in a sense, generally people, when people think today of religion in a globalized world, what comes to mind immediately is the ways in which religions, I would put it, profoundly misfunction in the ways in which religions are highly inimical to life, to flourishing life, and their whole set of precepts and practices and authorities are meant to kind of suppress life. Obviously that happens as well. I try to look at religious tradition from the other end. There's this other side, a highly ambivalent phenomena, but there's this other side of religions. And I think that great religious traditions are probably our most potent repositories of the visions of the good life, of the visions of flourishing life. And that's why I concentrate on them. My suggestion is not that there are not other alternatives to religions. Indeed, religions have been criticized even in their best form, and I think those criticisms are significant, ought to be taken into account. But religions bring something significant, and I think equally importantly, religions in fact are embraced by majority of the world population, and the world is becoming, for ill or for good, more of a religious place than it ever was, both in absolute and in relative terms. And so we have to take these accounts, work with them, and see in what ways they can be actually sources of significant wisdom for us.
So I'm a Yale undergrad. I'm being sucked inexorably to Goldman Sachs and into a world of the global economy and a certain value system.
Yeah.
What is a religion, pick any one or all of them in general, what is it offering me?
I think religion will offer you a sense that your life is not primarily about yourself. That you're joining, going to Goldman Sachs or whatever other firm might be a good option for you, but you better think in what ways it will serve something larger than just your individual needs. In what ways it can be tied to a sense of solidarity, solidarity at national level, but really also solidarity at the global level. It kind of frames, I think, your life by challenging you to ask, to what end am I working for Goldman Sachs? What are the purposes of my existence and therefore purposes of this particular activity that I undertake? I can be stellar at variety of activities that I do, but what ends do they serve? And I think that's the fundamental religious question, in many ways, fundamental philosophical questions, of purposes of human existence. This is what religions provide.
So what's equally as good as working at Goldman Sachs that religions can offer me? What's the compelling counterculture? Like, what's the substance of that counterculture?
I think it will depend on individual callings that people might have, but I don't see any reason why washing the feet of the destitute and helping them raise their children, why digging wells in Africa, or you name variety of things in which we engage our fellow human beings, the poorest of the poor, why that might not be as noble. Indeed, why that wouldn't be even more noble job than working for Goldman Sachs.
So you said it religions make us think of a context bigger than themselves and serving the poor in Africa, but every U2 song does that. And so why do you need the, it seems to me, aren't you taking God out of the equation in the religious conversation?
No, I think there are multiple ways in which encouragements of this sort can take place. So the question might be: so why? What role does God play? I think we live in the kind of environment, and again, a variety of ways one can probably get at certain of the goals that I'm describing, but certainly in religious traditions. In the context, say, of market economy in which we find ourselves today, in which new consumer goods are created, the new desires are being generated, in which we seem to be running faster and faster to stay in the same place, a kind of sense of relativization of ordinary life's goods, at least as portrayed in these kinds of our economic imagination, is extraordinarily important thing. I think religious traditions take us out of ourselves, take us into something that is transcendent, and free us from being compelled to pursue new gadgets in order to satisfy the craving of the self.
You are listening to a slightly cut version of an event that happened at Yale's Battelle Chapel on February 22nd, in which New York Times columnist David Brooks and Yale theologian Miroslav Volf interviewed one another about character, flourishing, and the good life. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and WHUS, 91.7 FM Stores, UConn's radio for the people.
Can you be good without God?
I think you can be good without God in this sense. I mean, I'm obviously a religious person. I'm a Christian. You can be good without believing in God, but that does not quite mean that you're good without God, right? If you are, as I do, if you believe that God created the world, that God created everything that is, indeed, that every breath of ours is dependent upon the existence of God, then you really can't be without God. But if you can't be without God, you can't be also good without God. So in a sense, the goodness, and if you postulate that God is a good God, goodness has its source, truth and beauty, and goodness have their source in God. And therefore, whether you actually believe in God or not, you are good on the count of their being.
Right. But you know, the book is about the uses that religion serves in providing a counterculture to global capitalism, really. And so someone who's not conscious of any transcendence, I mean, I observe in my own life a lot of religious people I know are completely wonderful, and a lot of religious people I know are complete schmucks. And a lot of atheists are wonderful, and a lot of atheists are schmucks. And it's harder than it should be to draw the line. And so if you have no consciousness of any transcendent realm, do you think you're at a disadvantage in leading a flourishing life?
Well, I mean, depending on what you think about transcendent realm, right? There are these, as you say, a lot of religious people are complete schmucks. And a lot of religious people also, indeed, that's the pervasive propensity of religions, and that's why religions deserve a critique, is to kind of instrumentalize religions for goals that are extraneous to the original teachings of the religious tradition. And so religions become kind of prosperity religions. Religions become quote-unquote political religions in the sense that their entire purpose is there to stabilize ordinary and secular order. In some ways, you can say this is already first step at the secularization of religion, at undermining what religion indeed ought to be about. I think we cannot properly flourish ourselves when other people aren't flourishing. In some ways, I think of flourishing as not individual, simply thing. It's a social flourishing. Flourishing of one person is tied to the flourishing of others, and therefore my flourishing is tied with the flourishing of the entire planet. And I think this kind of flourishing is being significantly eroded and in some places radically destroyed by the present form of capitalism.
Now, let me challenge you on that. The religion is based on love, as you write in here, and love is problematic because it's particular and it's preferential. And so when you start saying my flourishing depends on the flourishing of the whole world, it seems to me, aren't you watering it down and sort of having a vague global humanism and not any actual religion as we know it and see it?
I'm not sure. I think that global, at least the religions like Buddhism or Christianity or Islam, in certain respect Judaism as well, the Judaism is a particular case, they are global religions. They address individual and address potentially every individual in the same way. Who's my neighbor was a classical question, and neighbor turns out not to be my core religionist. Neighbor turns out to be a person who isn't my core religionist. So a kind of fundamental stance is actually to treat every human being as equal, whether one belongs to my group, in-group or out-group. And that, I think, is a very important dimension of the great religious traditions.
Yeah. So in the 1950s, there was Reinhold Niebuhr, there was Martin Buber, there was Abraham Joshua Heschel, there was Martin Luther King in the 60s, a series of religious leaders and theologians who took a very active role in the public square, introducing concepts like sin and grace and redemption into public debate. Yeah. It seems to me that there are very few of such people around today. Theologians or clergy who are real public figures, public intellectuals, in the way Reinhold Niebuhr was. And this book is sort of an attempt to get back in that world. So first of all, why did those sort of secular sermons go away? And is this indeed an attempt to bring some of the religious thinking to public questions?
Well, I think we find ourselves in a different, in a significantly different situation. We were, at the time of Niebuhr's, we were in a country that was, and indeed in the kind of, not just country, but the Western world, that was still, though nominally, culturally, to a significant degree Christian. When you have that kind of cultural environment, you can address with Christian conceptualities, you can introduce some of these concepts, and they will do some significant cultural work. If, as the culture becomes more pluralistic, you have less chance of doing this. And in a sense, in a different way, what I'm trying to do in this book is to kind of name a pluralistic context for us and to plead for the role of varieties of religions, including secularism, in the public sphere, bringing their visions of the good life. So what's similar that you've had in all the traditions, the visions of a good life teased out across those traditions are being brought into public sphere. I think this can be done and ought to be done in a pluralistic way. And the argument of the book is that actually religious traditions have internal resources to approach the issue in just such pluralistic way.
Two authors, the New York Times reasonably conservative columnist David Brooks and Yale's philosopher, theologian, founder of the Center for Faith and Culture, Miroslav Volf, interviewed each other about character, flourishing, and the good life. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and WHUS, 91.7 FM, Storrs, UConn's radio for the people. The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. If it makes you happy, it can't be that bad. If it makes you happy, then why the hell are you so sad?
So I read a book recently that said there are four levels of happiness. There's the just material gratification, very nice suit, nice handkerchief, nice car, that's fine, that's leads to happiness. Then there's ego comparative happiness, the pleasure we get being better than other people at things. Then there's generative happiness, the pleasure we get from giving back to each other. Mm-hmm. And then finally there's transcendence, some sense of one's place in a cosmic order. And it seems to me that we can have gradations of happiness, but we don't have to invest every Snickers bar in sort of a God's in transcendence, which it seems to me maybe what you're doing, no?
Well, I think if I'm just investing it with transcendence, my investments are going to dissipate very quickly. You know, so I think if there's anything, there is a kind of perception of the world as a gift. And obviously there are gradations of one perceived gradations of one's awareness. But that doesn't take away from the possibility of the intense pleasures that we have, seeing them as something imbued with more than just the thing itself and its particular relationship to me. But I think we have to talk about your book as well.
Shoot,
yeah. Well, you know, maybe just for the beginning, you build in your book on the distinction Rabbi Soloveitchik made between Adam the first and Adam the second. You use this slightly differently than he does. Can you just spell out who's Adam one and who's Adam two?
Yeah.
Or who's Eve one and Eve two?
I meant to make it gender neutral. But yeah, Adam one is the Soloveitchik, he's a great dualist. There's this line that there are two sorts of people in the world, those who divide the world into two sorts of people and those who don't. And he was a big dualist and believed in dichotomies and tensions. And basically Adam 1 is the building creative Adam. And Adam 2 is the inner and the spiritual Adam. One is majestic Adam, as he put it, and one is humble Adam. And so the way I formulate in the book is that there are two sets of virtues. One, the resume virtues, which make you good at your job, good at being a teacher. And then the eulogy virtues, the things they say about you after you're dead. Whether you're courageous, honest, honorable, capable of great love. And we live in a world, and I think I would include this institution, where we're a lot clearer about how to build the resume virtues than the eulogy ones. People have a clearer sense of how to have a good career than how to build a good inner character. It's not that people are bad, but they're just lacking a moral vocabulary for how to do that. And I certainly found that in my own life. I mean, the book really emerged because I'd achieved way more career success than I ever thought I would. But I hadn't achieved the sort of inner light one sees in people. I went to Frederick, Maryland shortly before finishing the book, and I ran to some ladies who teach immigrants English and then how to read, which can take years. And I just walked into this group of 35 women, age 50 to 75, and they just radiated a patience and a calm and a joy and just a tranquility. And just a goodness, they made me feel important. They had no idea who I was or anything. And you think, well, I've achieved this in life, but what they have, I haven't achieved that. And so it just struck me as important to know how to get there. And so the book is based on a series of mini biographies, and every single person was pathetic at age 20, but kind of magnificent at age 70. And so they weren't born good, but they did something to make themselves good. Sometimes humility is not the most positive virtue. If you're running for president and competing with Donald Trump. But I would say, basically, character is about relationships. And, I mean, if you want the Adam one, if you want this world reason to be a good person, I would say that the capacity to build trusted relationships is a very valuable commodity. So, for example, in World War II, they drafted hundreds of thousands of young men, and a certain number rose to the rank of major, and some stayed privates and corporals. And so they did a study. What are the factors that explain or correlate with those who rose and those who didn't? And it could be intelligence, it could be physical courage, but those correlations were extremely weak. The strongest correlation was having an intensely loving relationship with your mother. Because those who could accept and absorb and understand how an intensely loving relationship worked, when they became junior officers, they were able to endow that love to their men. And they rose. And in retrospect to the characters in my book, and there are people like Dorothy Day or Dwight Eisenhower or St. Augustine or Samuel Johnson, their dads were but their moms were all amazing. And so there is something about, and I think this capacity to love deeply doesn't have to come from parents, but it has to come from somewhere. And if you can love deeply, I suspect you'll do better off in the world in general. I think most people today they're way too focused on the promotions, and so they don't need, hey, if you become a saint, you might be able to be CEO. They don't need that. In my view, people just need, I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Christian Smith, who went around to college campuses and asked students, what's your last moral dilemma? And he's a sociologist at Notre Dame. 70% of the students couldn't name their last moral dilemma. They said, well, I pulled into a parking space, but I didn't have any quarters. I liked an apartment, but I couldn't afford the rent. And he would say, that's sort of a problem. It's not really a moral dilemma. And his argument was that they had not been given the vocabulary to understand what happens when two value systems conflict. And so they were reduced to sort of emotivism. What feels good for me is good for me. What feels good for you is good for you. And if you're reduced to that, then you really can't have a moral argument. You can't track your own moral development. You don't have the handholds to do that. And so one of the things that seemed to me important was to introduce theological words into the secular sphere. And so words like sin. Before the book came out, I did a Charlie Rose, and he asked me about the book, and I talked about it, and I got an email from an editor, not at my house, at another house, a very, very smart editor. And he said, I love the way you talked about your book, but I wouldn't use the word sin. I'd use the word insensitive. And it was like, well, that's why I'm writing the book. Because insensitive is not sin. But then you have the question, how do you introduce sin into the secular conversation? I mean, I think my calling for the last third of my career, whatever it is to try to shift the conversation a little out of politics and into morality. Just because I think work I do as a TV pundit, it's over-politicized and under-moralized. So I'd like to just shift it a little. But you got to meet people where they are. And actually, I talked to a pastor, a very famous one, who I'm sure you know, named Tim Keller. And I said, how do I talk about sin? And he said, don't talk about depravity. That's not going to sell. Or it's not where people are. Talk about disordered loves. And so, we all love a lot of things, and if a friend gives you a secret and you blab it at a dinner party, you're putting your love of popularity above your love of friendship, and we know that's wrong. And so that's sort of a accessible, I hope, a secular way of describing what sin is. We have a tendency to put a lower love above a higher love, and we do it all the time. And so, but introducing that concept of sinfulness, it seems to me, is core to character development. The whole logic of character development is based on identifying your core sins, whether it's vanity, greed, fear, and then trying every day to overcome it. And that's the first step in the process toward, I would say, flourishing, the ability to confront your own sinfulness.
So if there's a big enemy in your book, it's the kind of big me, right? In the sense that we've become a culture of the big me. I'm persuaded by you on this. But what exactly is wrong with the big me? A large percentage of Americans seem to relish the big me, and many of them have identified with the huge me in the right. How do you go about persuading folks that there's a problem with the big me?
First, humility to me is not thinking lowly of yourself. It's accurate self-awareness from a position of other-centeredness. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to be outside yourself and to see yourself accurately and see both your strengths and your weaknesses. And so that's what humility is. I would say the reason the big me is an unsatisfying life is because, I use the term that I guess Isaiah Berlin got from Kant, the crooked timber of humanity.
Right.
And so we are all crooked timber, and if you're relying on your own golden angel inside to lead you aright all the time, you're relying on a very flawed instrument. And so the argument was, the argument of the book, and I think it's insufficient now, but the argument of the book was you have to confront your broken nature, why you're crooked timber, and work every day to get better at it. I think what was wrong with the book was it was too individualistic. And in retrospect, the people I wrote about who really made something very impressive of themselves, they were not only capable of confronting their sinfulness, which Dwight Eisenhower was, his anger, or Dorothy Day was, just the disorganized self-indulgence she had as a young woman, but they were capable of making these amazing commitments to other things. And so they committed to four things, which was, and I think a life of flourishing, if I defined a life of flourishing, it was the quality of commitment to four things. To a vocation, to a faith or a philosophy, to a community, and to a spouse and a family. And if you can make awesome commitments to four things outside yourself, and surrender yourself to those four things, and forget yourself to those four things, then the byproduct of that, well, that is a life of flourishing, and the byproduct of that is the inner light, the joy that you see in people who are deeply invested in a cause, in a family, and who know what they believe. Viktor Frankl, this book, Man's Search for Meaning, he describes a woman who's days away from her death in the camps, in the Holocaust. She says to him, you know, I'm glad life has hit me so hard.
Yeah.
Because before this, I did not take life seriously, and now I do. And she's alone up there in the bed she'll die in, and she looks out the window and she can see a tree. And she says, the tree is my only friend. And I talk to the tree. And he says to her, does the tree talk back to you? And she says, yes, the tree says to me, I am life, I am life, I am eternal life. I would say at that moment, with that woman's sense of fullness, with her, not her own life, but just eternal life, I would say she's flourishing at that moment.
This is the audio of an event, courtesy of Yale University, of a February 22nd talk between New York Times columnist and all-around pundit David Brooks, getting into the deep end of the pool with Yale theologian Miroslav Volf, founder of Yale's Center for Faith and Action. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM Middletown, providing community radio that matters, and WHUS, 91.7 FM Stores, UConn's radio for the people.
I'm trying to describe, when I talk about the commitments, I'm trying to describe a life deeply embedded. Mm. So one of my characters, Frances Perkins, witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And she watched 58 people, rather than being burned to death, jump to their deaths in Lower Manhattan. Yeah. And it was sort of her call within a call, the moment when she became not only a do-gooder, which she already was, but ferociously dedicated to the cause of worker safety, which she then would spend the next 50 years ferociously dedicated. I mean ferocious. Compromising with anybody, working with anybody, doing anything for the cause of worker safety. And so she was a person deeply embedded in the world. But she wasn't always happy. But she was fulfilled. I have a friend who works in government, and she says, you know, every day in government sucks, but the whole experience is tremendously rewarding. And so sometimes that's true.
I certainly think that these kinds of experiences speak to the greatness of the character, and sometimes we need to go through these kinds of experiences in order to discover actually our own calling and depth of our character and what we are able or not able to do. But it seems to me that those are kind of the stages in some way, right? The stages, maybe necessary stages, necessary not just for me, but sometimes I sacrifice myself for the benefit of others, necessary stages given the state of the world in which we find ourselves. But the kind of image of flourishing life is this fullness in which all participants toward which we are through these sacrifices moving, right? Or something of that sort.
Yeah. So you're Mr. Joy, so I hesitate to have my own definition in front of you. But, but you know, I would say you have, when we talk about a flourishing life, it would have to include suffering. It would have to include moments of suffering where, you know, which teach us things, which teach us about ourselves, which enlarge our capacity for empathy, and which we turn into moments of narratives of sort of redemption. It would have to include love, moments of deep and passionate love to sort of plow open the ground and just enlarge our hearts. It would have to include moments of awed beauty. And then I think I would get back to the moments when it comes together. You know, I talk, and this happened a long time ago, I don't mention the book, but we all have moments in our life where we have moments where we think joy. And the one I talk about sometimes is I was doing the news hour on PBS, and it was a summer evening, and it was like 10 years ago, and I drove home to where I was living with my family, then in Bethesda, Maryland, and my kids, who were then 12, 9, and 4, had a little Safeway ball, one of those plastic balls you get at the grocery store, and they were kicking it up in the air, and they were chasing each other across the yard, and they were rolling over each other and tumbling and laughing and just having a great time, and it was like the perfect summer evening. The summer sun was coming in. My grass, for some reason, looked great. And so I pull into my driveway, which wraps around the side of my house, and I'm confronted with this tableau of family happiness. And I just sit there staring at it through the windshield. And it's one of those moments where you get overwhelmed by a gratitude which you know you haven't earned. And you want to be worthy of such moments. And so that's a moment of flourishing, but it doesn't feel like something you've earned. It's a superabundance of what you've earned. And that's why the transcendent element is always in the room.
Yeah, it's always there. And in a sense, that's how I think about joy as well. If it's completely earned, I mean, I sometimes say, you know, when you get paycheck at the end of the month, you know, you rejoice that you have a job that pays you, but it's when you get the bonus at the end of your year that it is a source of true joy. Yeah. There's kind of gratuity to joy, which I think is very significant.
But I would say joy could also come in the form of deficit. There are moments like, well, we've screwed up the word eros in our culture, the longing for excellence. Mm-hmm. Like when C.S. Lewis uses the words joy, he doesn't mean the satisfaction of desires.
Yeah,
he means the longing.
Yeah.
And Dorothy Day, her book, The Long Loneliness, loneliness for her is not solitude. It's the longing for God, really. Mm. And so it's not the satisfaction of desire, it's the desire itself. And so there's something about joy that's involved in the search. And so I'm talking about myself, but I'm a columnist. But so there are moments, we can all relate to this at work. So what I do, the way I write is I have a very bad memory, so I have lots of pages of notes and stuff, and I lay it out on the floor. And each pile of paper on my floor, my living room, is a paragraph. Yeah, exactly.
On the floor, yeah.
So each pile is a paragraph of my column. And I pick up the pile of papers, write the paragraph, throw it out, pick up the next pile. So to me, the writing process is the process of crawling around on my living room floor. And sometimes when I'm at the edge of my knowledge and understanding and concepts are happening to me and I'm aware that thoughts are coming into my mind, those are like very joyful moments. Mm-hmm. And it feels like prayer. It's like you're enraptured in something. And it's not because you've achieved it, but you're on the road. You're on the motion.
Yeah, joy is in anticipation. In the Christian terms, it's Advent kind of joy as well as in the fulfillment. Let me take you a little bit to less happy topics than joy.
Ted Cruz? Is that where we're going?
Well, we could start with Ted Cruz or maybe Donald Trump or the big me. And in some ways, I think both of them and maybe a few others as well. And the relationship of the kind of cultural occupation of the kind of big me and the kind of market economy that we today inhabit, not only generating immense disparities of wealth, but also being highly, highly competitive. And this high competitiveness of the market, I need to always present myself in my best suit. From the moment I get up, I need to look in a certain way, and I'm constantly projecting myself and selling myself in order to be simply able to achieve the goals which I have in order to live. Is there a surprise that we strive for the big me if our entire way of life is organized about, is a condition of possibility of our entire life, is the being of the big me?
Yeah.
So how does your critique of the big me, as well as the solution, fit in the what do you do with the economy which produces the need for the big me all the time?
Well, but I would say, obviously, if you're starting doing a startup, or trying to make yourself into a public intellectual, or trying to make yourself well-known in the world of marketing or whatever sphere, obviously self-promotion, Instagram, Twitter, is a part of that, and it's part of the self-promotion. And one of the things I mentioned in the book is how much fame has gone from a value that was very unpopular. UCLA does these studies of college freshmen, and it used to be what people wanted. They asked you, what do you want out of college or life? And it's, I want to have a meaningful philosophy of life. And fame, which used to be down near the bottom, is now usually second or third after financial security. And so becoming famous has become a very desired thing. Mm-hmm. And my favorite study of this is they ask college students, would you rather have a life that leads to a lot of fame or a life that leads to a lot of sex? And by 2-1, they chose the life of fame. And so I go to college campus and I say, listen, I'm on TV a lot. I write a column for a prominent newspaper. I'm kind of famous. Go with the sex, it's better. So that's part of one's career. Nonetheless, if that's all you are, you really will turn into Donald Trump. I mean, you will have no inner life. And my supposition is that having no inner life is a bad thing in the long run. Mm-hmm. My argument is the same as yours. You need a counterculture within yourself. You need an inner hold. Somebody, you know, the natural urge is to just want to make it in this world, and that's what the world rewards. And so you need some other community, some other value system, some other set of commitments that just impose upon you a different set of standards. And you know, to get back to what will help you in the long run, I have a friend who hires a lot of people, and the question he asks at every job interview is, name a time you told the truth and it hurt you. Because he wants to know they're going to put Adam 2 above Adam 1 sometimes. And so I tell all my students, learn to fake that one.
But you don't want... I don't hear you pushing at the kind of systemic question. So as a public intellectual, you're attending to the cultural responses to the situation. You're not asking the question, am I hearing you rightly, about how to, is there something not quite all right with a system that's generating such huge discrepancies in wealth and such?
No. I wrote about that all the time, but yeah. I would say that you're getting into my business and I'm getting into your business.
No, that's not right.
Okay, well, what I mean to say is I just think there is a vacuum for people to think about their own internal lives.
Oh, I'm great.
And you know, I was talking to some people just before this. I went on this book tour, and I'm talking about Augustine and love and Dorothy Day and moments of suffering and grace. And on this book tour, I sometimes go into rooms. I'm at a big convention center. There's a bunch of CEOs and treasurers, and they're talking about healthcare costs and their fiduciary responsibilities, and they look like the least spiritual entities on the face of the earth. And I walk in, and I'm going to do all this wahoo stuff about love. And I walk into the room at an airless convention center, and I think, this is not going to go well. And most of the time, they lock in. And more than any other talk or more than any other subject I've ever spoken about, there's a quality to the silence in some of those rooms, which is the quality of a desperate, thirsty group of people, and you're just like a sprinkler in the desert. And it feels like, it just feels to me the country is just hungry for this, and you don't even have to be that good, but if you're offering some bit of it, then there's a thirst for it. And I've had my students here say, we're so thirsty, which is why your class is so popular, aside from your talents, of course.
No, you're preaching to the choir here. I think it where I'm headed partly with it is this more integral account of of flourishing. I mean, there is a way in which I can find my own personal meaning without that translating into kind of a transformed lives that irradiate not just to my environments, but also to social institutions. Yeah. But I think we are probably...
I wouldn't disagree. But yeah. I just remind you, Emerson said souls are not saved in bundles. There's. I mean, I believe me. Half my columns are on social conditions and why Donald Trump sucks. But so I don't deny the importance of that. But I just think if you look at the where the public debate is, what's most needed is moral language to personal. We are a country that's politics rich and meaning poor, and the personal search for meaning is the biggest need.
So we won't have disagreement on that, but let's take from there. I think what might be needed, let's assume where the end, the road toward character ends. But what happens along the way? What are the kind of practices and helps along the way that one needs to have, not just to have moral ideal in front of one, but rather religious tradition, ancient philosophical tradition saw themselves as kind of communities of particular practices in order to help you along the way. How do you imagine that?
My answers are not controversial. I mean, you have to have experienced great love. We wouldn't say somebody was a deep person unless they were capable of great love that fused them one with another. We wouldn't say someone was a deep and emotionally successful person unless they'd overcome some challenge and suffering. Paul Tillich, who I quote in the book, says that what suffering does is it takes you beneath the everydayness of your life and carves a hole in what you thought was the basement of your soul, and it reveals a cavity below, and then it carves a hole in that and reveals a cavity below. And so it really introduces yourself to yourself. And then we wouldn't say somebody was a deep person unless they were deeply involved in some act of service. And so I quote, I'm forgetting his name. I'm blanking, having a moment. He was a famous doctor in the 19th century. He was a musicologist, and then Albert Schweitzer. And he said, I only hire people for my hospital. I don't hire idealists for my hospital. I only hire people who perform acts of service as if they're doing the dishes. Because those who are looking for the validation of idealism are not going to be able to last out here. And so we look for moments like that. Here's the University of Chicago and me coming out. I do think you have to do the reading. I do think you have to be familiar.
Good, thank you. This is very important. Do the reading.
So, you know, we tell students, come up with your own value systems. If your name is Aristotle or Nietzsche, maybe you can do that. The rest of us need to latch on to a tradition much wiser than we can be. And you simply don't know what the moral traditions are unless you do the reading. So I do think reading is an essential component. And then other things like being aroused by beauty, by awed by beauty, and drawn toward beauty. I mean, we can all, moments of transcendence. I think colleges can have a role in giving people moments of transcendence by offering them beautiful things. To look at, by encouraging them to fall in love with things. I think colleges play that role as part of the step, a role I think are mostly being abdicated right now.
This is a marvelous ending point to our conversation. Please join me in thanking David Brooks.
Was a chat between David Brooks, a conservative columnist and TV commentator, and Miroslav Volf, founder of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, about character, flourishing, and the good life. Find the full audio, among other bells and whistles of interest, at reasonablycatholic.com. Our next episode airs on March 29th, close enough to April Fool's Day that I won't be able to resist re-airing the Catholic joke show from a few years back, we Catholics being very good at laughing at ourselves. Till then, happy Easter and go Huskies! I'm Maria Johnson. See you in 2 weeks. Stay tuned for the Jive at 5, followed by Brass and Sass with DJ Thrasher.